Welcome back to the Mindful Hunter Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jay Nickel. And got a nice little Q&A episode for y'all today. Couple quick updates. So I've recently launched a new video series on YouTube. It's just called Mindful Hunting. And it's basically going to be all of the content that doesn't fit into my big adventure films. One of my big goals this year was to spend a lot of time scouting close to home in that kind of 2 to 3 hour window, and try and specifically develop some of my own mule deer spots. I've focused so much on, you know, big expedition type backcountry hunts over the last 5 years that I don't really have a lot of spots close to home to hunt. And I used to, when I focused on blacktail, I started developing a couple nice pockets, and then just kind of let that go by the wayside when the focus switched to bigger backcountry hunts. But now that I have some more time on my hands and I can kind of do both, I want to get back into developing some spots, and I want to share that stuff with you guys. So the new series is going to be less, you know, cinematic and more educational and more vlog type stuff. So last week I headed out for an overnight trip, hiked in to look for some bears while setting some cams for mule deers. That's posted on YouTube. Feedback has been really good. So if it's the type of thing that you're interested in, go check that out. And I would love some feedback. Filming another episode this week, kind of the same style. We're going to do a combo bear hunt, mule deer scouting mission, and got some other kind of bits and bobs that are a bit of a surprise in there that I'm excited to share with you guys. So head over to YouTube, check that out. As always, if you can help spread the content, it is greatly appreciated. Like, comment, share, subscribe. Leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice is probably the most beneficial thing that you can do that has the greatest impact on actually spreading the podcast itself. But posting something to your stories and even just liking it is greatly appreciated in this kind of algorithm-driven world we all live in. All of the help is appreciated. I know there's a bunch of drama right now on Instagram over verification, and everybody who's a content creator is kind of worried if they don't get verified that Instagram is no longer going to push their content. I'm not personally sure if that's true, but it's just another example of how little influence and power we actually have in these social media platforms. And we're kind of just, you know, along for the ride at somebody else's party. So that would be greatly appreciated. Other than that, I don't think there's a whole lot going on. Maybe a couple quick review updates. I apologize for the lateness of the Peaks versus Soffran headlamp battle. I basically announced that I was doing that right in the last week or two of prep, and my brain was just fried mush, and I didn't have the ability to dig into the analytics the way that I wanted to. And then since I've been back, things have just been busy. I have taken the Soffran out on an overnight hunt, and I have done a couple preliminary tests at home, and they're pretty damn similar at this point. Like, it's pretty wild, but I will have that posted before the end of the month. Also, I have started the next category review. We are doing binoculars, and I'm looking at 6 pairs. Swaro NL Pure, they're all 10x42. Swaro NL Pure, Leica Noctavid, Leica Geovid, or is it the Trinovid? 2 pairs of Leicas, anyways, Zeiss Conquest, a Para-Athlon, and a Tract. So that will also be released by the end of the month, and I will be raffling the winner of that review. The best pair of binoculars will get raffled off. And then what else? Oh, I just gave away a meter on Mindful Reviews, one of the Bluetooth meat thermometers, the new Meter Plus that goes up to 165 feet. I personally love cooking with that thing. So if you're interested in, you know, free prizes, head on over to mindful-reviews.com and sign up. And then next month, I'm giving away a knife made by Back Knives, BAC, Bruce Culberson. It's a skeletonized processing knife. It was my favorite processing knife I used last year, and I needed another one for this year because I gave that one away. So when I bought one from him, I said, listen, sell me 2, and I'm going to give one away. So I'll be giving that away the first weekend in July before I head to Europe for 2 weeks. So listen, that's about it. Let's dive into the Q&A. Now, let me tell you how this works. There are essentially three places where you can submit questions. Place number one is mindful reviews. Those questions get priority. I answer those first. Place number two is directly on YouTube. I threw up a comment. That's still kind of new to me, so I got some engagement on that, but not a ton. That'll get your questions answered. And then obviously, place number three is Instagram, and we have a ton of questions there. Now, it is currently 5:30 in the morning, and I have to drive to Kelowna today and get back, hopefully, by the time my kid gets out of school. That's about an 8-hour round-trip drive, if everything goes well. And I'm picking something up. Stay tuned to find out what it is I'm picking up in Kelowna. But, like I say, it's 5:30 in the morning. I still have to prep my meals for the day. I still have to get my kid ready, get her breakfast ready, get my breakfast ready. So I'm setting the clock on an hour. It's 5:30 now. I'm going to get through as many questions as I can by 6:30. And if I can't bang them all out, what I will do is put the rest up on Instagram or something like that. We'll get them answered one way or another. So without further ado, let's jump into this. Okay, when, where, for what, and why do you personally choose to use higher magnification binos? For example, 12 to 15x over 10x binos and spotters when hunting. Do you ever pack 10s and 15s and no spotter? Do you ever pack all three? What would be your go-to on an August bear hunt in New Mexico? Thanks, Jay. Yeah, no problem. So my answer to this 2 years ago is different than my answer now. And yes, I did multiple times go on hunts with 10s and 15s. I had a pair of Zeiss Victory 10x42s, and I had a pair of Swaro SLC 15s. And that was a deadly combination, but heavy as sin, man. Like, just brutal. But for stuff like Arizona coos deer, where your hikes are minimal and you're hunting out of a truck every day, I think that's a great setup. You can kind of handhold the 10s, tripod set up the 15s. I think it's a very successful combination. And I know a ton of dudes in the Southwest that still run that combo now. The other time that works really well is when you got a partner. So let's say you got a partner sheep hunt you're going on, and one guy can carry the 10s, the other guy can carry the 15s. And then maybe somebody's got the tent and the other guy's got the spotter. Like, there's a way to kind of balance it out. I think that's another situation where that works really well. I don't think it is reasonable on a backcountry hunt where you're carrying your own optics, solo or otherwise, to take 10s and 15s. I think you would have to be hunting from a truck or splitting your optics with a partner. Now, the reason I don't carry these anymore is that the NL Pures came out. Now, one of the magic things about the NL Pures is because of the field flattening with Swaro Vision, they are able to fit the field of view of a pair of 10 powers with 12 power magnification. Now, increasing your field of view decreases relative handshake. Now, your hands are always going to shake the amount that your hands are going to shake. However, the smaller the field of view, the greater the apparent handshake, because the less space, I guess. I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this. It doesn't even really matter how I explain it. Here's what matters. The smaller your field of view, the greater the apparent handshake, or the greater the apparent impact from your hands shaking. And so the reason historically most people didn't run 12s is that A, the field of view was a little compressed, so they weren't as practical as 10s, but also because it's very difficult for most people to handhold 12s. But when you increase the field of view to a typical 10 power field of view, all of a sudden handholding 12s becomes very practical and very doable. But you still get the zoom of a pair of 12s. So now that I run 12 NL Pures, it's kind of a perfect blend between 10 power and 15 power. So I don't run that anymore. For a bear hunt, if you had a spotter, I think 10s and a spotter, like let's say you don't own a pair of 12s. You just own 10s, 15s, and a spotter. I think 10s and the spotter would be perfect because bears are not typically that hard to glass. They're these little black blobs. And depending on the terrain you're in, they stick out pretty noticeably. Remember, they're predators, so they're not as worried about concealment as prey species are. It's not a deer. It's not an elk. It's not something that's worried about mountain lions. So the way that they behave makes them much easier to glass. So you're going to pick up a bear with a pair of 10s from a long way off. And then you break out the spotter and see if he's worth going after. I'm not sure the bear size in New Mexico or the regulations surrounding boars and sows, but we are asked to not shoot sows in British Columbia. It's illegal to shoot a sow if she's with cubs. And so you really want to spend some time pretty close trying to distinguish boar from sow, which can be quite difficult at times, especially with certain bears. And gauging size on bears can be tough, and doing it through a spotting scope is not always the best because it always looks bigger in a spotting scope. So I would like to be within a few hundred yards to gauge size of a bear anyways. But if size isn't that big a deal, or if the bears in the area are all of a similar size, so you know, it's not a priority for you, then I don't think that's an issue. But I think if that's what you own, I would take the 10s and the spotter and I would leave the 15s at home. The exception for that is that if I was hunting coos deer in the Southwest, then I would bring the 15s and the spotter. Glassing coos deer is extraordinarily difficult, and you really are picking apart small little terrain features, and I think 15s are ideal for that. All right, Peyton asks, how is the new base layer? I'm looking for a new synthetic that breathes and dries very quickly. So this is another thing that I'm doing in this new video series, is that I have all this gear coming in, and I want to kind of give interim reports before I give full-blown reviews, just because I know a lot of people are in a situation right now where they're trying to buy gear before the season, and waiting for me to come out for the review might not be the most practical time frame. So I bought a couple new base layers this year. I bought a Lululemon Dry Sense hoodie and a Cool Engineered hoodie, and that's K-U-H-L. And this week I wore the Cool Engineered hoodie on the hunt that I went on, and I was very impressed. There's a bit of a higher polyester content in this one, so it doesn't stretch as much as other synthetics. It keeps its shape a little bit better, and I find the polyester stuff, while it's not as comfortable on the skin, like the Lululemon is insanely comfortable, but it's also super duper stretchy, and I don't feel like it dries as fast as the base layer with more polyester in it. I'm very impressed, and it was $100, and that's pretty reasonable for a technical base layer. You're going to spend a lot more than that for most of the big hunting camo companies. It's got a hood. It had nice length to it. It's got thumb holes. Now, the colors aren't super conducive to hunting, so I do plan on dyeing it a little bit of like a homemade camo moving forward, but I'm very impressed so far. My buddy Vance asks, what distance do you tend to practice at with your bow? What do you think of as your max range, and have you or will you change anything from your bow or arrow setup from last year? Thanks, Jay. I got tons of archery questions this week, and it's actually very encouraging because I love archery, but it doesn't do the best on YouTube and the podcast, which is I don't directly care about. But what that does tell me is that it's not a priority for most of the people who listen to the podcast. There's more rifle hunters that listen to this than archery hunters, and I don't want to focus exclusively on archery and ignore all the rifle guys. But when I start getting tons of archery questions, it makes me happy because it's kind of my true love and I get to talk about it a little bit more. So the field that I practice at is in meters, not yards. So kind of add 10% to all these numbers. And I would like to improve this, but typically I like to shoot out at 60 or 70 meters, which would be 65 or 75 yards. And I'd like to pull that distance out, but that's as far as I can shoot at that field. And I live downtown Vancouver, so I'm kind of limited as to where I can practice. What's important is that I like to practice about 10 to 15% further than what I consider my maximum lethal range to be. So the furthest I've ever taken a shot on an animal is 55 yards. And it was like a perfect condition in Arizona. I 10-ringed this mule deer. It was a beautiful situation. He had no idea I was there. I would not shoot an alert animal at that type of distance. I wouldn't shoot at wind in that type of distance. But this was just, it was an ideal circumstance. And I was kind of like in all these oak and mesquite. And it was like the window I had was the window I had. And if I didn't take it, I probably wouldn't have got another one. So I would say 50 to 60 yards is as far, if things were absolutely perfect for me, that's as far as I'd shoot. And that's not so much as a skill question as it is like a time question. You start getting further than that and the arrow is in the air for a very long time. And a lot of things can happen on the other end before the arrow shows up that are out of your control. Like the animal just deciding to get up and walk away, the animal turning to look at you, the animal jumping the string. You know, lots of things can happen. So yeah, if I'm going to practice at 75 yards, my max range is going to be 60 yards. Let's say something like that. You know, and here's the deal. I like to have all of my arrows landing in, let's say, like a 6-inch diameter circle. I can't remember what ring that is on my target, but there's two inner rings that are yellow. And that whole section is about a 6-inch diameter circle. And I want all my arrows landing in that circle at 75 yards. And that tells me I'm comfortable at 60 yards, for example. And the reason I do that is, and I'm just going to throw a number to this. I think most times under pressure, you are about, let's say, 10 to 15% less effective than your ideal circumstances while practicing. And I've found this to be true with everything. You know, I used to compete in DJing. I used to compete in jiu-jitsu. I used to compete in CrossFit. And you don't typically have the ability to operate as well in competition circumstances because there's stress involved. There's all kinds of factors out of your control. And so you want your performance during practice to be better than you need it to be during the real world scenario. Like I like that 10 to 15% buffer range so that if I'm not at peak performance during the heat of the moment, I've kind of built that into my system. So I have a bit of a leniency window, if that makes any sense. And then he asks, and have you or will you change anything from your bow or arrow setup from last year? No. The only thing I'm kind of considering is using a new release. I kind of want the Ultra View. I shoot with a hinge. It has a magnetic clip on the hinge and it can have a handle that wraps around your wrist, like a band, not a handle, but you know what I mean? A strap that wraps around your wrist so you don't have to hold it in your hand the whole time. I currently shoot with a True Ball Fulcrum Flex, which I love, but it doesn't have a strap on it, but I have seen how I could rig one up, but it doesn't have a magnet on the actual release, the clip part of the release. And so you're constantly having to hold that with your finger as you walk around and get ready for your shot. And it's kind of one more thing that could go wrong. And so, but that UltraView lease is like $300 or something. Like, and I'm having a very hard time justifying that. Like, I've killed a schwack of animals with the release I currently have. So, I mean, it works. There's no real need to upgrade. So no, I don't think I'll change anything, and I'll get into my setup later on because there's some more kind of detailed questions about what my setup is. All right. Dave asks, which of your hunts are you planning to film this season? All of them for the most part. I think the only one I might not film is my guided whitetail hunt in Saskatchewan. I kind of made a promise to myself that at least one hunt per year, I wouldn't film, just to help me just enjoy myself and focus on it. And I don't know, this is my own opinion, but especially for these guided hunts, like I can see like a guided grizzly bear hunt in Alaska being film worthy. Like, that's crazy. Yeah, film that. But like a guided whitetail hunt in Saskatchewan, like what's going on? You know what I mean? You're sitting at a lodge, you're going to get in a side-by-side, you're going to drive to some blind or stand, you're going to sit in it all day, hope something walks by. If it does, hope you can shoot it, and then go home. Like, there's not much of a story there. Now, getting some film of the animals, if there's like really cool bucks kind of coming in, sure, that might be interesting. But I didn't start making films for kill shots. I started making films to tell stories. Here's the whole reason I started making films, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast. My first backcountry blacktail that I took solo with a rifle, ended up calling it in. I'd spent like 20 days in the area. I'd set cams up. Like, I busted my ass for that deer, and he's not even an impressive deer. But when I got home from that hunt, it was such an incredible story. And I'm a decent storyteller, and I was trying to convey this story to, you know, I was doing my MBA at the time, and, you know, those people had no, you know, context for people who were solo hunting in the mountains, and they were all just blown away. And I'm trying to convey this story, and verbally, like, it wasn't sufficient. Like, it just wasn't getting it across. And I'm like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And then all the hunt films I was watching and the hunt content on YouTube at the time, and still to this day, 90% of it is, you know, garbage sponsored mess. And I was like, I can do better than this. And then, you know, I think it took me a while to actually do better than that. But I do feel like the stuff that I produce is better than a lot of the other stuff out there. But the whole reason was to tell the story of the hunt. And actually, my most successful films, I don't even kill anything. And I think the reason I can get away with that is that I tell stories. I tell stories about adventure. I tell stories about getting to know yourself. I tell stories about failure and how to deal with that. And people, that resonates with people. And I, for me, sitting in a stand all day, you know, waiting for a big buck to come across is just, you know, not the kind of story. And I don't want to shit on anybody else. There's lots of big whitetail channels out there. And if you look at like the Hunting Public or something, now that's a story. Like, what those guys are doing is crazy. And they are super talented. If I was hunting whitetail like that, I would be telling that story as well. Like, they are crazy impressive. But for a guy like me, who's not a whitetail expert, who's just going on this hunt because I like, it's a new style of hunting for me. And I think having the patience and tolerance to sit around all day in the cold is a new challenge for me. But again, I don't know as if there's much of a story there. So I think I'm going to film all the rest of the hunts. So sheep in August, caribou and goat in September. Might do a little bit of filming when I'm helping out with archery mule deer in October. And then might fit something in December. And then for sure, my archery mule deer in New Mexico. That's probably one of the films I'm most excited about this year. I was going to bring somebody to film it for me. And then I realized that's just not me. And that's not what I built this, you know, channel for. So I'm going to do that hunt solo and I'm going to film it solo. And then hopefully a goat hunt with a buddy as well. So I'll tell you this right now, 2023 is going to blow every other year that this channel has been active out of the water. There will probably be more hunt films this year than the last 3 years combined. My schedule is insane. My wife is fully on board. I have organized my life that hunting is my priority, and I'm making, this is the big push, like between the reviews and the hunt films. This is the year where I try and get over the hump and make this my full-time gig, along with, I still have some other kind of like consulting work and kind of business admin work that's going to help me kind of close the gap. I don't need hunting to provide 100% of my income. I need it to provide, you know, maybe 50%, and I can make up the rest pretty easily. So yeah, lots of hunt films. All right, let's head over onto YouTube. All right, so here's another archery question. Not really a question per se, but I would like to see your archery shot process. And so I can do a little bit of video on this, but I'm also going to save you guys a bunch of time. I'm a disciple of Joel Turner, and I was very lucky in that a buddy of mine, actually I met him afterwards. So I can't remember where I heard about Joel, but I took his online course maybe 4 years ago. And then Joel actually doesn't live very far from me. And I emailed Joel and I said, are you doing any type of seminars? And this is before Joel was doing any of these, like he might've done like one workshop a year at that point. He hadn't really like blown up yet. And I emailed him and I said, hey man, are you doing any type of like workshops or seminars? I loved the online stuff, but I'm still kind of struggling with a few of the concepts and I would love to get some, you know, personal FaceTime with you. And he said, come to my house, man. He's like a 2-hour drive away. I was like, when? He's like, now. Can you come tomorrow? I was like, yeah. So, you know, and funny thing is I asked him, I'm like, what do I owe you for this? And he said, nothing. He said, you buy the course, you get access to me. It's simple as that. So if you're having issues, come on down, we'll fix them. And I was just blown away. Like, Joel is an interesting character for sure. Like, he's a unique dude. And so it's like, he's a little quirky, but he's extremely intelligent, extremely thoughtful, extremely detail-oriented. And he cares very deeply about impacting people and helping them with the issues that they're facing. And so I went to his house and I think we spent like 4 hours shooting. Like, it was like a one-on-one workshop that was like nothing else, man. That was when he got me to switch to a hinge release. It was super impactful. So my shot process is basically like an adapted Joel Turner shot process. I believe in open and closed loop systems. I believe in deciding when to shoot. I believe in executing a shot process so slowly that you can stop at any time. I don't believe in punching the trigger. It's not that I don't believe in target panic, but I believe that through proper shot execution and release choice, you can avoid target panic. So there's a lot of self-talk involved in my shot process. So maybe if that doesn't answer the question fully, but for anybody who's interested in target panic or a more thoughtful approach to shot sequence, I recommend doing, if you can't get to one of Joel's in-person seminars, I recommend doing his online course. And maybe if I get enough interest, Joel's a friend. And so I've asked him to come on with a podcast before and he agreed. It's just a matter of scheduling. But if you guys want me to get Joel on the podcast, I kind of feel like with some people that I could get on the podcast, they show up on so many other people's podcasts. If I don't feel like I have the ability to add a unique perspective from what everybody else is already talking to them about, it's like, listen, I don't want to just do it for the views. And I think some people have done some phenomenal podcasts with Joel, so I didn't really feel compelled to add anything. But if you guys want it, like, Joel will come on, so just let me know. All right, let's head over to Instagram and answer those questions. Also got a ton of nutrition questions this week, which I love to see. So, is adding protein to your post-workout recovery necessary, a good idea, or not needed? I would respond to your question with a question, and that is a two-part question. What are your goals, and what is your current nutrition look like? So, for starters, are you trying to build muscle? Are you trying to maintain? Are you trying to lose weight? Because that's really going to dictate what your overall protein needs are. And then based on what you're eating throughout the day, are you satisfying those protein requirements? Now, most studies have shown that this concept of an anabolic window is kind of BS. So there used to be this very prevalent opinion that there was this kind of magic anabolic window 2 hours after you worked out, where your body was particularly sensitive to macronutrients. So getting carbs and protein in post-workout was like back in the day, man, we would have our protein shake in our gym bag, and like you would drop your weights from your last set and smash that protein shake. Otherwise, you felt like you wasted your entire workout. And most studies have come to show that if you're hitting your protein goals throughout the day and your carbohydrate goals throughout the day, like if you're at a maintenance level of calories, there's really no benefit to having carbs and protein specifically post-workout. Now, when that changes is when you're in a deficit. So if you're trying to lose weight and you are in a caloric deficit, then placing specifically your carbs pre and post workout is particularly beneficial because it's going to give you the energy to work out, and then it's going to replace your glycogen stores. So when I get deep into a prep and I'm only getting a little bit of carbs every day, they always come immediately before and after my workout. But for most guys like us who listen to this podcast, that's not really an issue. I like to say most people should be at 1 to 1.5 grams per pound of body weight. So if you're a 200-pound guy, you should be somewhere between 200 and 300 grams of protein per day. Now, an average protein size serving of 8 ounces is going to have about 50 grams of protein in it. So if you were eating 5 servings of meat every day, or, you know, you could have one or two of those be eggs, and you were hitting 250 grams of protein every day, then there would be no particular benefit to having protein immediately following your workout. But I know most guys aren't going to eat that much meat during the day. So the question is really, what do you need to supplement your diet with to hit your goals? Other than when do you need to supplement it with? Because there's nothing magic. If you're at maintenance calories or in excess, there's no magic window post-workout. But it's a good time. Also, most people have, if you're training as intensely as you should be, most people have problems eating whole meals. Because that's the other thing I would argue. Actually, if you need to be hitting your macro goals and you're not, you'd be better off having a whole foods meal than a protein shake. But most people, myself included, have a hard time eating directly following a workout. Like, I need an hour or two to calm down, for my system to calm down. So having a shake in that window is a good idea. What's more important for me is carbs post-workout, to be honest with you. So my current diet, I have 100 grams of cream of rice, dry weight, and 50 grams of protein in a shake post-workout. And again, there's no magic about having it post-workout, but that's where it fits best. But I do like replenishing those carbs right away. And in fact, when I'm at maintenance calories, I don't really worry about carbs pre-workout, because I think it takes longer to digest than most people think. And replenishing the glycogen is kind of more important than preloading the glycogen, if that makes any sense. So, and I would argue, if you're looking for a drinkable carb, Highly branched cyclic dextrin, HBCD, is kind of the best post-workout carb. It would be like the Ferrari of post-workout carbs. Dextrose and all that stuff and maltodextrin is not really that good. You're going to get a huge insulin spike. It's not ideal. Cyclic dextrin is certainly my choice if I'm going to drink carbs post-workout. But yeah, at the end of the day, if you're hitting your protein goals, no need for a post-workout shake. If you're not hitting your protein goals, a post-workout protein shake is a great way to hit them. All right, let's get controversial. Would you consult for the Wild Sheep Society of British Columbia to help maximize their revenue raising and marketing? So I'm going to tell a little story without telling a little story. My company was hired by a not-for-profit conservation organization, which you would recognize the name of if I told you. It was not WSS BC, to do a large-scale project kind of overhauling and giving them a workbook or a game plan on how to market more effectively to their chosen demographic and how to have a greater impact on opinion and perspective. Because that's one thing you need to think. Putting out material and building awareness is not the same thing as changing sentiment. And unfortunately, most conservation organizations are in an echo chamber. And they're just talking to people like them about stuff that they like. And so because they stay in that echo chamber, they feel like they're being successful. But if you actually look at the impact, like I think, you know, the hunting population is somewhere around 5% in North America. And so even if we were to create 20% more hunters, which would be crazy, that would be insane if we could increase the hunting population by 20%. That would only result in 6% of North America being hunters. That is still literally nothing when it comes to voting power on regulations and all these things that constantly happen that threaten our way of life. The real way to have impact is by creating or impacting sentiment among non-hunters. Because if you could take there's a giant population of fence sitters who like don't have a direct problem with hunting, but don't really know any hunters. And they're kind of just going to float whichever way, you know, they feel like their friends are floating because they don't want to like stick out. But there's an ability to impact the sentiment of those people and build allies, in my opinion, specifically with a group that we came to call non-hunting outdoor enthusiasts. This would be like rock climbers, mountain bikers, hikers, mountaineers, bird watchers. Because if you look at what's important to them, it's the same thing that's important to us. And this is the protection of wild spaces. And if we can build allegiances and impact sentiment positively with those people, all of a sudden 5% turns to like 30% because they're a gigantic percentage of the North American population. And if they would support us in the things that we go to vote on, that would be like a 10x impact compared to just trying to create more hunters. This is one of the reasons why BHA has completely ditched their previous model, which was like the three R's, and recruit was a big one of them, because it's been shown that spending a massive amount of money trying to recruit new hunters doesn't actually have that big of an effect. And if you're trying to protect the lifestyle that you love, there's more efficient ways to do this. Anyways, this was I did a ton of work in this area. So this is one of the reasons why I feel confident talking about this the way I am. Here's the problem. We did all this work for this organization and they did nothing with it. And I've been a part of a few conversations behind closed doors in a few of these organizations. And how do I say this without coming off as like jaded and negative? my consulting organization is heavily data and evidence driven. We don't have opinions. As a behavioral strategist, I do not have an opinion. What I have is the ability to present to you a plan based on academically peer-reviewed research that will give you a statistically higher likelihood of success if you follow it. Period. The problem is the people who are in charge of most of these organizations have these really strong beliefs about this is who we are and this is how things should be done. And regardless of how clearly you can show them how doing things another way would be more successful, they're not going to change. This is one of the reasons why I don't, you know, go out. Listen, I believe in conservation. I put my money where my mouth is and I fund conservation organizations. But like, I'm not the guy going to BHA pint nights. I'm not the guy trying to sit on boards of these things because, and again, I hate to sound jaded, but like I've met the people who are running these organizations and for the most part, they're not particularly open-minded. They're not interested in new research about how to do things more successfully. They just want to keep, and I've talked with the people as a professional consultant who run some of these organizations. I work with Fortune 500 organizations and I've had conversations with CEOs who are like way more open-minded. They're like, holy shit, man, that is super interesting research. How do we apply this? What do we do? And the same research and the same conversations I'll have with these like small conservation organizations are like, oh yeah, that's okay. Okay. They walk away and they just throw it in the garbage. And it's just like, all right, man, you know, if you don't want to help yourself, there's not a whole lot of help I can give you. Now, this might seem kind of apathetic and maybe, you know, maybe I should be more involved and maybe I should fight harder from the inside, but I've always tried to be very realistic about how I can have the greatest impact in my community. And I choose to do that through my hunting films, through my gear reviews, through the podcast. I think that's how I personally can use my energy most efficiently to have an impact because I've tried working with these organizations and it was met with zero success. They were not interested in it. And the reason I know this is that I've had behind closed door conversations with the one or two members and directors who are open-minded, who are vocally frustrated with the way things are. And they're like, I can't believe people aren't going to listen. This is amazing research. We should be doing this stuff. So listen, I would love to be able to take advantage because I'll be honest with you, these organizations are operating in the dark ages. When it comes to the reason we keep losing these fights is that the organizations that are on the other side of the table are utilizing cutting edge marketing, behavioral research in order to influence their chosen demographics. And the hunting organizations are not doing the same. Why did we lose the grizzly bear hunt? It's like taking a knife to a gunfight. The organizations who were opposing us in that were so much more sophisticated and so much more well-funded. We didn't stand a chance. And I'm going to be honest with you, I haven't seen anything change since that happened. The conservation organizations are still utilizing the same kind of old, broken techniques. And I don't see a desire to change. If that changes, I'm here. Give me a call. I'll work pro bono. This is what I do for a living. And I don't mean to be arrogant, but I'm very good at it. And if I can help conservation organizations, I would love nothing more in the world. But based on the experiences I have had thus far, I don't see anything changing. So I hope that wasn't too controversial. And I hope, I'm not trying to shit on these organizations. I understand why it is. You kind of have these old boys clubs and they've done things a certain way for a very long time and they feel comfortable doing it that way and change scares them. Like, it's not that I don't understand why they won't change, but I'm not going to bash my head against a brick wall if the desire for change isn't there. Any plans for more blacktail hunting this year, or just mule deer, elk, etc.? I have no specific blacktail plans. I definitely don't feel like my work is done with blacktail, but I've killed enough blacktail that I feel competent in my blacktail hunting. Also, blacktail hunting is very, very challenging. The terrain is shit. You don't see a lot of animals. There's a lot of aspects to blacktail. This is why I have so much respect. There's a guy in Chilliwack, Adam Sarich, and I think he goes by 4 Point Outdoors on Instagram. And the dude is a killer. Like, he smokes big ass blacktails every year. And the amount of respect I have for that guy, like, I think they're the most challenging deer species in British Columbia by a mile. But I still haven't killed a mule deer in British Columbia. And I really want to. And I also, when I think about how I want to spend time in the mountains, I'm looking to be in that more mule deer terrain. I want to be in stuff that's a little bit more open. I want to be in stuff where I can glass a little bit. And blacktail hunting is just a lot of still hunting. It's a lot of luck. It's a lot of cam work preseason. It's a lot of thick, dark timber. So yeah, it's not a priority this year. Will it come back? Absolutely, at some point, but not this year. Do you ever follow a bull elk bugle with a cow call from the same location? What's that technique? 100%. So one of the techniques you hear people talk a lot about is like an elk party. And essentially what you're doing when you're calling for elk is that you're trying to create a situation that increases the interest of another elk in what you're trying to pretend you are. Now, there's different things that generate interest from elk, primarily breeding and fighting. So if you can create a situation where another bull, preferably a bigger bull, thinks there's a small bull with a cow and it has a chance to beat that bull, it will come and investigate the situation. So also, sometimes just cow calls alone can be more effective than bugling. But doing something like a couple of smaller bull bugles and then followed up by like a bunch of different like mews and cow calls to basically create the perception that there's a smaller bull with a handful of cows just over this ridge could be very enticing for a bull. So 100%, try it out. Can't hurt. How does diet, training, and routine change from normal to 3, 2, 1 months out from a backcountry hunt? Again, I need more context because I would want to know what state are you coming from and what state are you trying to get to? Like, if you're a guy who stays, okay, look at my buddy Kevin, who runs the Focus Hunting podcast. Dude is a machine. I guarantee there is nothing about his life that changes from 9 months out to 1 month out because he's always in fighting shape. Now, a guy like me who likes to put on some muscle, there is going to be a difference between my off season and my on season. And that difference could take two forms. One form would be I'm kind of heavy and I want to put on weight. Another form could be I'm kind of light and I need to lose some weight. Here's what I like about this question is that he starts at 3 months out. What I would advise is don't do anything drastic before a backcountry hunt. When I see people trying to lose 10 pounds right before a hunt, I cringe. I would rather people show up 10 pounds heavy, but strong and fresh and well-fed, than show up 10 pounds lighter and emaciated and weak. So if you need to lose some weight for a backcountry hunt, do it slow and steady. And in general, I prefer to feed up going into a hunt. Like the last couple weeks before I go on a sheep hunt, I normally eat whatever I want. I'm kind of looking to put on 5 or 6 pounds of fluff because I know I'm going to lose it in the first 4 or 5 days. And that fat on your body is just caloric storage. Like it is energy that you're going to be able to access later on in the field. So the question I would ask is, what is the ideal state you want to hit this hunt at? Is it 210 pounds at 12% body fat? Okay. If that's the case, 3-4 months out, what do you need to do that you could execute slowly and steadily leading into the hunt that would have you at those metrics that you want to hit while being well-fed and energetic? So there's no crash dieting going on. Now the training, I normally stop training legs about a month out from backcountry hunts and I go solely backpack cardio. And the reason I stop training legs is that I train legs so hard, there's no way I'm doing backpack cardio for 3 or 4 days after I train legs. And that only gives me 2 days to do cardio and then I'm back at my leg day. So I normally only get like one cardio, like one weighted backpack cardio session in per week. And I like to be at 3 or 4. And the only way I can do that is stop training legs. So I will typically go down to lifting to 3 to 4 days a week instead of 5 days a week. And I will implement 3 to 4 backpack cardio sessions per week. I'm doing so much scouting this year that the hiking I'm doing during the scouting missions is kind of taking the place of that. Like the mission I went on last week was an overnight mission. I think I hiked 12 or 13 miles, which is close to 20 kilometers over the day and a half I was out. And I had a 60 pound pack on for the majority of it. So I just let that be my cardio for the week because I want to let my legs rest and recoup. And I still have my leg session at the gym in my routine. All right, my buddy David followed up this next question with an email kind of adding some more context, so we're going to dig into this one. What do you recommend to keep your energy and legs going when the big hike is on? And so the additional context he added was like, okay, float plane drops you off. It's time to start hiking. What are some things, you know, maybe nutritional supplements or other items that you can take to give you a boost in energy? And I actually sent back my meal planning PDF because I believe this is more of a macronutrient timing question than like a supplement question. Here's the deal. There's no free lunch in like physiological systems. So if you were going to take something for a burst of energy, you're going to pay for it later on. Now, if you're close to the summit and there's a sheep up there and you just need to sprint up and you're dead tired and you've been hiking for 14 days and you want to take some type of like caffeine energy shot, I mean, go at it, because if you don't make this last push, you might lose your shot. So who cares if you bonk afterwards? But in a regular situation during the hunt, I don't recommend any like concentrated energy products because they're just going to kick you in the ass later on in the hunt. Like you're going to have lots of energy for an hour or two and then you're going to bonk. What I do recommend is properly planning your food. So I've talked about this a lot before, so I'll give the condensed version. If you want the meal planning PDF, go to mindfulhunter.com/tools, enter your email, download the PDF. And essentially one section of it talks about having carbs if your proximity to activity is short. If you're going to be hiking within the next 10 to 15 minutes, try and eat primarily carbs. If you're going to have an hour and a half break before you have to hike, then you have your proteins and your fats. And this will make sure that between fatty acid oxidization and your access to carbohydrates, you are going to have access to optimal fuel at the appropriate times. And that's the best way to look at that question for me. So if I just got dropped off at the plane, I'm going to have some energy chews or something else that's kind of like pure carbohydrates or simple sugars. And then I'm going to time the rest of my nutrition appropriately throughout the rest of the day. And because I would have known I'm going to be getting out of that plane a couple hours ago, I would have had some type of high fat, high protein snack an hour and a half or 2 hours before the plane even landed, so that my body was primed once I got there. Like, think about it, back up a step or two and say, what do I need to do a couple hours before this to be in the best situation? Does upper body strength help you at all in backpack hunting, or is it strictly cardio legs? No, I think there's a base level of upper body strength that is required. I don't think you need to go crazy with it, but I do believe that, you know, some basic resistance training, and it could even be body weight stuff, but like working in pull-ups and push-ups and some type of pressing, shoulder pressing movements, I think is definitely optimal, because you are only as strong as your weakest link. So even if your legs are super strong, if your back starts to go out from carrying your backpack, or if your core is weak, you know, you're going to pay the price for it. So I don't think it has to be your sole focus. I don't think you need to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I do think being strong in all areas is highly advantageous. Taylor asks, best tick repellent. I got swarmed this year turkey hunting. I don't have any recommendations for this because I never have to deal with ticks. I will say people have said good things about the Equinox. I believe it's the Equinox system from Sitka, which has baked in tick repellent into the clothes. I know Barklow worked really hard on this, and I would look into that as kind of a first line of defense. And then I think it's called Promethrin. It's like this spray. And I would like duct tape the cuffs of my pants. I would spray my boots and calves with Promethrin. I would do the same thing at my wrists and up to my elbows and around my neck. Yep, that's the best I got. Mule deer strategy breakdown. How, why, when you move glass, etc. Well, based on my limited success hunting mule deer, I'm going to stay in my lane here and not answer this question, because it is not something like I feel like I'm an expert in, and I'm still learning. What I will do for you is get a mule deer expert on the podcast and ask him or her that question. Do you worry about your truck getting broken into in the field? I kind of think about this. Sure, it's never happened, but I do. It's one of the reasons why I have a lockable canopy. I try and hide things so that there's not like big steal me stickers. I wouldn't leave a $5,000 spotting scope visible in my back seat. In fact, I try not to leave expensive stuff in the truck at all. And if I do, I leave it in closed totes, preferably in the cab, but if I have to, in the locked canopy. I worry about it more at hotels. I empty my truck into my hotel room every time I stop. And I always try and talk myself out of it. Oh, it'll be fine. And then I'm like, what if you wake up, you're 15 hours from home, and everything you need to hunt gets stolen? You're done. And I'm like, it's going to take 10 minutes, man. Just empty the truck. And it's a giant pain in the ass, but I do it every time. But I'm way more worried about my truck getting broken into in some dodgy hotel than I am out in the field. So that's how I approach that. What's your favorite piece of gear you take on every hunt that's under $100? I covered this in my most recent video. It's my coffee mug. It's called a GSI Microlight. It's 500 milliliters, and it is the perfect coffee mug. It's got a sealable lid. I can make a cup of coffee in the morning. I can drink half of it. I can throw it in my pack. Every time I stop for a break, I can have a couple sips of coffee. I love that coffee mug. So there's your answer. A breakdown of my archery setup. I am shooting a Hoyt RX7 Ultra at 70 pounds with a black gold Pro Hunter HD sight, gas ghost camo strings, an Epsilon a Hamsky Epsilon cable-driven drop-away rest. I'm shooting Black Eagle Rampage 300 spine arrows. I have Iron Will components up front. I believe my entire arrow setup with point weight is 475 grams, and I'm shooting 295 feet per second. I use AAE 2.6-inch hybrid vanes with a four fletch. I think that's everything. And that thing is shooting laser beams. This is the best archery setup I've ever had. All right, two more quick ones, and then we're going to shut this down. Number one piece of advice for someone embarking on their first solo backcountry hunt. Just go. Just go. Stop thinking so much. You know, I think I'm partially to blame for this because I go into these like ridiculously long explanations of everything, but like, don't overthink it. Make sure you've checked all your boxes and you're being safe, but do a little short trip first. If you've never done one, do a single overnight. Just hike in, set up camp, have some food, hike out in the morning. Experiment with being alone, but don't stress about it. Don't overthink it. Just get out there and have some fun. No matter how much planning and preparation you do, there's still going to be things you screw up and forget. So just get out there, have some fun, take some notes while you're there so that you don't forget the things that you learn and the things that you forget, you know? Yeah. And good for you, man. And let me know how it goes. Last question. Thoughts on ATVs versus electric bikes for hunting? I think they both have a place. I've experimented with a mountain bike. I haven't hunted a lot on an ATV. That might be about to change. I think it really depends on the terrain. A lot of the stuff that I've hiked, I don't think would be conducive to an electric bike where the ATV would, because I think you need to have a trailer for the electric bike. In the ideal situation, you'd have one of each. That would be phenomenal. But I don't think most people have that kind of money. And I think if I had to have one or the other, I'm going ATV. But I would love to experiment more with an electric bike, especially these new big fat tire ones with like a nice little trailer on it. I think that would be great. All right, folks, there you go. Another Q&A episode in the books. Thank you all for the thought-provoking questions. Again, if you could like, comment, share, subscribe, help promote the podcast in any way, it would be deeply appreciated. If I can help out in any other further way, jay@mindfulhunter.com on Instagram, mindful_hunter. Go check out the new video. Let me know what you think. Let me know what your plans are for this year. Got lots of stuff coming down the pipe, so super eager to keep putting out content and keep building this thing. Could not be happier with the engagement that I'm getting from everybody, so thank you again. I truly appreciate all the support. This is what I love doing, and this is what I want to do with my life, and you guys are the ones that make that possible. Again, if you're interested in joining a community of like-minded individuals who love to nerd out on gear, support each other, and basically just create a positive environment, come over and join us at Mindful Reviews, mindful-reviews.com. Buy raffle tickets, get entered to win cool shit every month, and participate in a great community. So until next time, thanks for tuning in.